Hello and welcome back to the Neurotransmitters Podcast, a show about everything related to clinical neurology. I am your host, Dr. Michael Kentris, and I'm very fortunate today to have another special guest, Dr. Jamie Wright. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm extra excited to have you on the show because I've been meeting a lot of people on Twitter in the medical Twitter space, you being one of them. You have some excellent posts up there for people who are curious, but you have a very unique perspective. So you're a neurologist in training. You're an MD, PhD. Tell me a little bit about yourself and kind of what led you into the field of neurology.
Yeah, so I kind of say that I was almost born into it, or at least I joke that I was born into it. So I was born 6 weeks premature, which may or may not have had anything to do with me developing congenital hydrocephalus. And I was diagnosed at 4 months old. Didn't have my first shunt placed until I was 20 months old. That's like a whole nother story. But growing up, I had a few revisions here and there. I was always, very studious. And I remember even in elementary school, my teachers joking that I'd be a neurosurgeon one day. And I was like, it wasn't even on my radar, even though like I saw a neurosurgeon every year. And then I didn't really give much thought to having hydrocephalus until I had a shunt revision when I was 6 years old. And, it just kind of was what it was. And kept going. And then I had 2 shunt revisions 2.5 years apart in high school. And it was that second one. It was my junior year of high school where it really kind of sunk in that I was going to have to deal with this for the rest of my life. And, the key kind of moment for me was it was a month before AP exams. And as I said, I was, very studious, a little nerdy. And I was talking to my neurosurgeon because thankfully it was like a kind of a mild enough, or, quote unquote, mild enough shunt malfunction that we were able to kind of plan it out. And I was trying to get her to postpone it until after AP exams. And she told me, she's like, well, if you don't do this, it's going to get worse and worse. And then you're going to go into a coma and die. And I was just like, wow. Yeah, this is like to 17 year old me. And during that same conversation, my mom was like, but she just had a shunt revision like 2.5 years ago. And kind of other truth bomb, like neurosurgeon was like, yeah, 50% of shunts have to be revised within 2 years of surgery and of being placed. And, those were kind of 2 things that I never really thought about and hadn't really sunk in. So I had the surgery. I did fine on AP exams.
Okay, good.
I did great. Graduated valedictorian, went on to undergrad. And I really wasn't planning on going into medicine. I majored in molecular biology, but I'd met some doctors that I had bad enough experiences with that I was kind of like, I don't know what they do to doctors during med school, but I don't want it to happen to me.
Yeah. That is an entire conversation right there.
Yes. Yes. But I had all these great med school, like pre-med friends, because, I was in molecular biology, I was in the biology. So all my friends were pre-med and they were all like, Jamie, why aren't you becoming a doctor? Like you, like, have the perfect experience for it. And it wasn't until the end of my junior year of college, I was working in a lab, doing research. I'd gotten a fellowship to do research full time and working with this amazing pediatric intensivist. And he worked with a lot of other pediatric intensivists and meeting all of them and just seeing how much they cared and how passionate they were about the work and, how great their attitude was. And I was like, you know what? I do want to become a doctor, but I also want to do research. Yeah. And so that's when I decided to go the MD PhD route. So I was kind of late to the game from that perspective.
Now, what has been the area of your research?
Well, so that research was actually, I was studying perinatal white matter injury in a mouse model. So that was kind of more in line with kind of where my future goals are. Then for my PhD, I did my PhD work in a medical genetics lab studying kind of some rare gene mutations that lead to cerebrovascular and cardiovascular disease. So a little bit farther away, but it was with an amazing mentor and really excellent training. And, you know, that's what you really want to go for a PhD. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find a lab that was like right in the niche that I was looking for future-wise. You know, as far as my future research, because, you know, surprise, surprise, I want to do research on hydrocephalus and something more focused in that direction.
Now, like, let's take it back to like a 10,000 foot view. You know, I know most of the people who listen are in the medical field in some capacity or another, but for those who might not be familiar with hydrocephalus, in broad strokes, how would you describe to someone who wasn't familiar?
So how I describe it to people is kind of the layperson definition is that it's when, like, we all have fluid in and around our brain, and it's there to, like, cushion and provide nutrients and stuff. So it has a purpose. But in hydrocephalus, that fluid, for some reason, accumulates abnormally. So it builds up either because it's not being absorbed back into the system correctly, or it gets blocked somewhere in its circulation. But it builds up, putting pressure on the brain, and that can lead to, of course, leads to a lot of symptoms for the patient, but it also can lead to brain injury and, as my neurosurgeon put it, you know, so bluntly, death if left untreated.
And correct me if I'm wrong, CSF dynamics or cerebral spinal fluid dynamics is just, it's kind of a hot area that's building up a little bit in terms of interest in the, at least I've been noticing, thankfully, the last few years. Yeah.
Yes.
And like so many things in neurology at large, it seems a lot of the difficulty in its research is that there's so many different mechanisms that can lead to the same kind of problem.
Right.
So clinically, it's hard to differentiate the underlying cause. So for instance, like in your case, you mentioned congenital hydrocephalus. So I know a lot of times, like, quote unquote, idiopathic, which I always explain to my patients is like, it's doctor speak for, we're not sure why it happened.
Exactly.
Is that an accurate characterization of most congenital hydrocephalus?
I think in large part, yes. One main or common cause of congenital hydrocephalus is aqueductal stenosis.
Oh, okay.
So kind of as, you know, to explain what that means, in the CSF circulation, there's ventricles. There's the lateral ventricles, which are the largest on either side of neither hemisphere of the brain, kind of up towards the top, and those drain down into the third ventricle, and then that fluid drains down into the fourth ventricle. And between the third and fourth ventricle is this narrowing called the cerebral aqueduct, and that narrowing can get easily, it either doesn't develop properly so that it's either too narrow or blocked, or it can become blocked by scarring, bleeding, all kinds of things, tumors, that sort of thing.
You know, when I was a baby neurology resident myself, you know, they kind of teach us communicating versus non-communicating, or let us say obstructive versus non-obstructive hydrocephalus. But it may not be quite that straightforward and simple. Is that something that's been on your radar as well?
I mean, it's been on my radar from the fact that my mom, like, has one idea of what type of hydrocephalus, of like non-obstructive versus obstructive that I have. So, you know, and looking back in my old records as a baby, I was like, I don't know what type of hydrocephalus I have. And then now my doctors, because originally they thought I had non-obstructive hydrocephalus or non-communicating hydrocephalus, or communicating hydrocephalus, which meant it was non-obstructive. And then now my doctors are think, oh no, maybe it's obstructive hydrocephalus. So I don't know much from the research sphere as far as...
It may not be as black and white in every person's case.
Yeah, it's not as black and white. And especially if you don't have those original images. And I know in the hydrocephalus community, like the patient community, some people kind of know what theirs is and kind of make own it more than others. And then as far as like in the medical community, I feel like we are kind of leaning away from putting as much weight on that, except for when it comes to treatment options. That's where it really comes in to play. But even now they're thinking, you know, maybe it's not as black and white as we thought it was.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Because you obviously you've mentioned, you know, these shunts several times, but could you enlighten us a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, the only treatment options for hydrocephalus are some sort of neurosurgery or brain surgery. There's two main ones. The kind of oldest is, well, this is arguable when you know the history of hydrocephalus, but the most commonly used is a shunt. And what a shunt does is it's essentially a tube, like a long tube that they put into the ventricles, attach it to some sort of valve, and then run a tube down either into the abdomen or the heart or the space around the lungs to drain the fluid. So it's just a big drain, essentially, is like the easiest way to look at it. The other option that is actually goes back pretty far in history, but has kind of been more refined and perfected in recent years is something called an endoscopic third ventriculostomy, or an ETV, which is where they take now an endoscope or a camera and down through just a small hole in the skull into those lateral ventricles, so those large ventricles, and they actually go through the lateral ventricles down into the third ventricle, so that next ventricle down, and they make a new opening for the CSF to go through. And that's where this whole debate of communicating versus non-communicating or obstructive versus non-obstructive can be important when determining who's a good candidate for an ETV, because an ETV is the preferred treatment modality more and more because you avoid a shunt and all the complications that come with a shunt. You know, because I mentioned the 50% failure rate, at least in the pediatric population, it has the highest, I think the highest failure rate of any implanted medical device currently. And then there's also an infection rate, and infections are a big deal with shunts. And so you avoid all of that if an ETV works for them.
So you've mentioned you've had to have these revisions multiple times throughout your lifetime. Mm-hmm. Now, is it usually during your annual checkup with your neurosurgeon, they're like, oh, we need to revise this? Or is it like, I'm having symptoms that prompt a reevaluation a little more urgently?
I haven't gotten to an annual checkup in a long time. So in 20, you know, I thought I was doing pretty well because I went almost 10 years between shunt revisions. And I was actually in my first year of graduate school. So for my MD-PhD program, I did 3 years of medical school and then went into graduate school. And then after graduate school, did my fourth year of medical school. And it was during my first year of grad school that, like, during this time, I've always had headaches. Like, ever since, for as long as I can remember, I've had headaches more than most people. But during college, they started getting worse. And I would go to my neurosurgeon and look at my imaging and tell me it's fine. And so then I went to a neurologist and I started being treated for migraines. And I tried literally dozens of migraine medications and nothing was working. And I moved for medical school and actually... the head of pediatric neurosurgery took over my care while I was in medical school. And he started talking about this phenomenon of some people with hydrocephalus, their ventricles stop enlarging. Mm-hmm. It's called ventricular noncompliance. Some people call it slid ventricle syndrome, but that's a whole other story. Like, that's a whole other talk as to why that's not an accurate description. But we started talking about that and my headaches kept getting worse and worse. And then finally I got to a point where I couldn't sleep through the night because I'd be woken up by a headache. And, you know, imaging completely stable. And finally I went to my neurologist because I was like, this is my red flag symptom. This is a symptom I always have when my shunt's failing. And that's, you know, how it was when I was growing up is I would start having headaches that woke me up in the middle of the night and they'd get worse and worse and worse. And so finally my neurologist was like, I know your imaging stable, but this is increased intracranial pressure. Like, this is ICP. And so she called my neurosurgeon. My neurosurgeon and I made the decision for me to have exploratory surgery. So exploratory brain surgery. Cool. And he got in there and my entire shunt was malfunctioning. Like, he had to replace the whole thing. And so we have no idea how long it was malfunctioning. He said it could have been malfunctioning for years, you know, as your headaches got worse. So I've had those type of malfunctions. And then after that surgery, and after we knew that my ventricles no longer enlarged, I've had 14. So that was in 2015. And I've had 14 more neurosurgeries since then, just in that time span. And, you know, one of them was kind of the scariest shunt malfunction I've ever had in my life. And I was literally just fine. Like, I remember brushing my teeth that morning and thinking, I cannot wait until my follow-up with my neurosurgeon and my neurologist to tell them how awesome I'm doing. Because I'd had six other surgeries that year. And so I was like, we finally got it. Like, we finally figured it out. And I went into lab and I was sitting at my desk and all of a sudden it literally felt like a bolt of like lightning or a bolt of pain just went through the top of my head, down my spine. And it was just this, and I don't want to use the term thunderclap headache because I don't want to, you know, lean all of my medical people in that direction, but it was just this sudden onset, worst headache of my life. And I started to stand up because I was alone in the room and my vision started blacking out and I felt like I was going to pass out. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't want to pass out here by myself. And so I was freaking out what to do. And I finally sat back down in my chair because I was like, I'm not going to make it to the door to get out to the hallway. And as like my vision is blacking out, I'm trying to like text somebody to let them know that something's wrong. And thankfully, when my ICP got tagged, that's what it turned out to be, like my shunt had locked in that instant and my pressure rose. And thankfully for me, I get what they call plateau waves. And so the pressure goes up, but then it comes down for a little bit. And so, and this gets into like a lot of ICP dynamics that's kind of down a rabbit hole. But essentially, I was actually able to like, you know, the pain wave passed. I was able to get up, walk, go tell somebody what was going on, like what had happened. And I'm like, okay, I'm gonna wait about a little bit and see if it happens again. That's just my personality. And so I actually like went to lab meeting and I kept having these, you know, these plateau waves, but I'd be fine in between. So I was able to function in between, but they were getting worse and they were getting closer together. And so finally I called my neurosurgeon and he's like, go to the ER. So I went to the ER and I actually was still really reluctant to, like, I still wasn't sure whether or not it was a shunt malfunction, even though now looking back it was obvious. But because like during these waves, my vision would black out. I would be like shaking uncontrollably, you know, horrendous pain. I started vomiting. I mean, it was like, clearly something was off, but they, you know, admitted me to the ICU for the night. And then it was finally like a friend of my mom and my mom ganged up on me over the phone and were like, they called my neurosurgeon at like 4 o'clock in the morning and were like, you have to revise your shunt. And sure enough, the catheter going into my abdomen was blocked. It was completely blocked. That's the other extreme of, you know, how shunt malfunctions can happen. During that time, like I also had an endoscopic third ventriculostomy. So I also have cool video of the inside of my brain. Unfortunately, it didn't work at all for me, but I got cool video, which you can see on my Twitter. But yeah, like it's been a lot of like issues with like trying new valves because of overdrainage, and then I have underdrainage. So we had to switch out the valves and then shunt malfunctions mixed in. Last year during my intern year of residency, I had my shunt externalized, and kind of one of the most interesting things with that is we like clamped it off, and like within an hour and a half, my ICP reached 100, which for those of you who don't know, a normal intracranial pressure or ICP is like 5 to 15. And so it's been quite a process.
So, you know, I know you said, right, most shunts have a 50% failure rate within 2 years. But it seems like yours have been a little more frequent than that.
Yeah. And I mean, this is where you get into, you know, it's averages. Some people, I know people who've gone 10, 20, 30 years, the same shunt. I know people who, you know, have a shunt revision every year or have, you know, I know people who've had shunts fail in the PACU after surgery. So it's just very unpredictable. Yeah.
Now, with your history, I mean, I, for one, think it's very obvious why you would choose to go into something related to neuroscience. But what was it specifically, your history of hydrocephalus as a child and through the remainder of your life, that led you into neurology or some other path that led down that road?
So what it really came down to was, especially during medical school, because I made the decision to share my story on social media. I started sharing my experiences as a medical student dealing with hydrocephalus and, you know, chronic illness. And I had so many young adults reach out to me who were in that kind of in-between period between their pediatric care transitioning to adult care. And so many young adults kind of fall off the map or are, it's more like pushed off the map because, and I mean, I had this unfortunate experience because like my pediatric neurosurgeons were wonderful, but when I turned 17 and my neurosurgeon of 17 years retired, they were like, you know, why don't you go ahead and find an adult neurosurgeon? And that was it. They didn't tell me who, they didn't have any recommendations. They didn't have a process. There was no connections. There was no like, let's help you transfer your records. At least there's none of that. There's no process. And you know, there was a time where I had like 20 something year olds or teenager or, you know, people in that kind of transition period who were I was hearing from somebody like once a week who was messaging me saying, I can't find a neurosurgeon or a doctor to take care of my hydrocephalus or manage it. And I met this amazing neurosurgeon here at the University of Washington or here where I'm training now, who is a neurologist who specializes in particularly patients with congenital hydrocephalus who are transitioning from pediatric to adult care. And he is, you know, he's made a niche of taking in those patients and managing their hydrocephalus, managing their shunts. And he works with some, you know, amazing neurosurgeons here who, you know, he has this like great expertise in CSF circulation and ICP monitoring and shunts. And so he takes care of these patients and he manages them. And, you know, he does any like monitoring or anything or testing that needs to be done. And if they're, you know, if he determines that something's wrong with their shunt, then he passes it off to the neurosurgeons. But he's made this, you know, great practice of being able to like care for these patients. And that's where, you know, so I was like, that's who I want to be when I grow up as a neurologist.
Is that Dr. Williams?
Yes, that's Mike Williams.
I think I heard him speak at the plenary session at the Academy meeting just this year.
Oh, really?
I think he had a pro and anti NPH does it exist debate. It was quite quite entertaining. And he gave a very good account of himself.
Yeah. That's very cool. Yeah, he also does, you know, he also treats a lot of patients with normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is kind of its
own thing,
its own thing among hydrocephalus. But yes, he's helped me out so much over the years. I think the first time I actually like flew up to see him and have ICP bond and a train done here in 2019, back when I still lived in Texas. Mm-hmm. I traveled up here to get, you know, his input and testing. And he just knows so much about shunts. And it's so fun talking to him because he gets like, since I got a new shunt system last year and I can hear it now, like I can hear the CSF going through it sometimes when it's like going really fast, like when it's high pressure and like draining a lot. And, you know, I told him about it because I'd heard people talk about being able to hear it and I thought it was crazy. And I asked him about it and he's like, oh yeah. And he started talking about the science behind it and the type of valve that you can hear it with. And we both got really excited. And it's so fun talking to somebody who can get as excited about hydrocephalus as I do. So
it's really excellent that you found, you know, a physician who is that passionate. But, you know, you kind of alluded earlier that not all physicians are necessarily as, say, kind-hearted, perhaps.
Very true. I was going to say, I've been very fortunate. I've lucked out. But I've also, all of my surgeries up until the last 2 years were done by pediatric neurosurgeons. Mm-hmm. And so I lucked out in that I found pediatric neurosurgeons who would still manage my care. And I still have a pediatric neurosurgeon on my team here.
So, you know, being active in kind of the online sort of support community as you are, is it a common experience that people will go to their neurosurgeon and be like, oh, well, you know, your ventricles are normal size, you need to see a neurologist, or, you know, then they go see the neurologist and it's like, well, it's your shunt. And so you end up kind of stuck in the middle of this contest between your two neuro physicians, essentially. Yeah. Is that a common story?
It is. I mean, thankfully, my situation with the ventricular noncompliance, it's, last I heard, it's maybe about 10%, although I think it may actually be more than that. So it's not as common a phenomenon. But yeah, there's still like plenty of patients out there who even, you know, who get stuck in the middle between either neurosurgery just not listening to them and sending them, or, you know, wanting them to go to somebody else. Or I do strongly advocate for patients to also have a neurologist, because it was my, you know, if remembering back to that long story, it was my neurologist who was like, this is your shunt. This is a shunt issue at the beginning. And advocated for me from that standpoint. And so, you know, I'm biased, but I think, you know, I think it's a neurologist is an important part of the team for patients with hydrocephalus. Even if, you know, we don't do surgery, we still, like, we're the great diagnostician. but also it can be very challenging for patients to find neurosurgeons who will, you know, take on a patient with hydrocephalus, especially with those complex patients whose ventricles don't enlarge anymore, or have a seemingly functioning shunt, but are still having headaches due to like over drainage or under drainage. And, you know, who are patient enough to figure out, like, try different valves and try different settings and figure that issue out.
Now, I have to ask, I can't help but notice that you are in an adult neurology training program and not a child neurology. So what happened?
Well, and I mean, it really comes back to that, you know, because I thought going into medical school, I thought I was going to do pediatric neurology, because that's where you see a lot of hydrocephalus. But, you know, after talking to all these young adults looking for hydrocephalus care and seeing the need in the adult world, that's when I made the decision to do adult neurology instead of pediatric.
That makes complete sense.
And yeah. And so, you know, kind of, I hope to help fill that gap and encourage others to help fill that gap for patients with hydrocephalus. I think it's, you know, definitely an opportunity.
Excellent. So you're in your second year right now. Is that right?
That's correct.
And with shunt malfunctions, with chronic headaches, I think anyone who's been through residency can say, you know, it's hard, even if you aren't dealing with a chronic medical issue, How have you been holding up so far?
It's been rough. I had two surgeries during intern year, and I had two hospitalizations, two heart surgeries during intern year, and thankfully, the program, the internal medicine program director was like very nice about it and helped me ease back in and everything. But I've continued to have like my headaches have worsened and I've continued to have shunt issues since then. And so I had another, neurosurgical procedure in March of this year. And after that, Dr. Williams and my neurosurgeon, Dr. Bono, who's also been fantastic. They were both like, you're torturing yourself trying to work through these issues and these setting changes and these ICP changes and everything. And they're like, I think you should take an extended leave of absence. Because at that time, I was only planning to take a month okay, we're going to, do the procedure, figure things out. And then I'll keep going. And they're like, no, we think you should take longer. And so I did make the difficult decision to take a 6-month medical leave. Thankfully, my program has been very patient with me about doing that because I know it's very hard on them because neurology programs, aren't huge like internal medicine. But, they've been patient and I've been on medical leave and we've been slowly kind of adjusting my shunt, trying to figure things out. And, as I said, I'm very fortunate to have a wonderful medical team. I think I have around like 12 or 13 doctors following me right now. So, it's a lot of appointments. Yeah. My weeks are generally, full of appointments, but yeah, we're working on it and hoping that hopefully I'll be able to get back better than ever. So
you have obviously made, a lot of progress. You've a lot of kids with hydrocephalus don't grow up and get double doctorates. So I think you've posted a little bit about this in the past online as well. But for kids who have hydrocephalus or families who have children with hydrocephalus, What do you think is the most important thing for them to know and to keep in mind as they go into the future?
I think, and it's, it sounds very cliche, but keep your mind open, and anything's possible. Like, don't limit yourself or limit your child or, out of fear of, but they have hydrocephalus. Hydrocephalus, it's very much a spectrum and it affects everybody differently, but there's so much as patients with hydrocephalus, there's so much we can do and there's so much possibility. And, my advice to parents is always support your child in any way possible. And, by support, that can also mean like therapies, special education classes, and, all those supportive measures or like accommodations can also be, very helpful and very important to helping them succeed and do everything they want to do. But, don't knowingly or unknowingly, hold them back or restrict them because of a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well said. Any final thoughts that you would want to share with our audience today?
We kind of talked about this a little bit earlier that, I think part of that aspect of not limiting yourselves is the medical community, not limiting, and taking a chance on physicians with, chronic medical conditions and disabilities, and making them a part. Because, I'm very fortunate to be able to share my experience with my co-residents and even my attendings sometimes, my experience as a patient and what I've kind of gleaned from that.
Do you want to dive into that for a minute? I know you've said had you mostly good experiences, but I know, well, I shouldn't say, I shouldn't assume. Let me lay, medical training can be grueling and insensitive to people at the best of times. How has your experience been?
It can be grueling and insensitive at the best of times. you know, and well, and that's where I, like, I don't know how much I want to get into, like, the nitty gritty of, you know, who did what and what were good decisions versus not so great decisions or not so beneficial decisions. But I will say, like, overall, I have had some amazing support from during my residency training. And, you know, everything from them just being patient with me to, you know, checking up on me, doing meal trains, you know, going above and beyond. I've also had some not so great support during residency training. You know, we're all human, and we all have our moments, and residency training is very grueling, and it's hard on my co-residents and my program, me not being able to be there for 6 months and them having to cover for me for 6 months. And, you know, I definitely appreciate that. I think the system as a whole can definitely do better as far as making things more accommodating to residents with disabilities and chronic health issues. Because as I said, you know, I think we have a lot to give. We have a lot of additional perspective and additional knowledge that not every trainee has, because, you know, everybody has different experiences. And so I think there's a lot of to add there, and there's a lot of benefit. And I think it's worth, you know, making some accommodations to help those, you know, help residents like me succeed. And, you know, the accommodations process is tough, like, and it's tough at every level. I will say, you know, I had accommodations because of all the surgeries and everything. I had accommodations starting in grad school, well, actually starting in undergrad and then grad school in my last year of medical school. And, you know, some people who aren't dealing with disabilities or aren't dealing with chronic illness think accommodations give people with disabilities or kind of give them an unfair advantage in situations. You know, sometimes people have that idea or that kind of bitterness, and I could see how it'd be especially strong in residency training because we are all pushed to our limits. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the process for getting and coming up with accommodations is, like, incredibly hard. Like, I've spent so much of my free time in meetings. Like, and so, you know, that's, you know, just kind of some food for thought as far as that goes. And I think that process can be simplified and made more, made easier and more approachable. And I think a lot of residents would benefit from that. I mean, then you know, there's Lisa Meeks does great research on doctors with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think she came out with some recent research that showed like 52% of residents with disabilities never go through the accommodations process, never even try to get accommodations. And, like, that's a whole nother conversation, maybe for another day.
Yeah, it does speak to the kind of the underlying philosophy, I hesitate to use the word philosophy, but like kind of mental state of medical training as a whole, which is still very much entrenched in many corners of the United States, where it's like, you know, you have to be, you know, this sacrificial lamb on the altar of healthcare in order to get everything. Yes. You'll pardon my overwrought imagery. But, you know, I've been very fortunate with my own health thus far in my life. But, you know, I've had co-residents who had, like, you know, really bad ADHD or, you know, like, conversely, insomnia or other things. Like, their cognitive performance just suffers. And while I'm part of the 80, I'm doing air quotes here, 80-hour work week limitations, I think everyone knows that at some point, these are a little bit of a fiction. And, like, you're awake for over a day. And if you're already having health issues, probably not great for those health issues. Right? It's not great. Like, I worry. This is my own neurosis kicking in. Like, all these times being on call or not having, like, you know, 7+ hours of sleep per night. You know, how many years have I shaved off my life? How much higher is my risk for dementia? I don't know. It's probably more than it would have been.
I mean, you know, it's significant for all of us. And I'm grateful that there is a push in general, like overall, to make residency more and healthcare more humane, honestly. Right. Because it's not humane right now.
I saw a Twitter thread just a couple of days ago. I was getting into the rabbit trails for a second. It was saying, like, you know, keep the work schedule, but bring back the cocaine.
Oh, I didn't see that.
For those who aren't familiar, residency programs were being developed back in the 1800s. I might be a little off on my decades. Maybe it was the 1910s. But the people in charge of it were a little bit high on cocaine and hence were able to get an incredible amount of work done. So, anyway, in cheek, I'm not truly advocating for everyone in healthcare to be on cocaine, but it would be nice to get...
Something's got to give.
I'm just saying, more regular sleep would be good for everybody, right?
Right. Very true.
Well, very true. Dr. Wright, thank you again for coming on. Where can people find you online, or in what resources, if any, would you recommend people with hydrocephalus or those taking care of someone with hydrocephalus should seek out?
So as far as resources, the Hydrocephalus Association is it's a great resource. It's a great resource for both patients and clinicians, because they have a whole publication search engine. They're available on their website, and the website is hydroasoc.org. So hydroasoc.org. And they also have, you know, great support resources, community network resources. So if you have patients with hydrocephalus, definitely check them out. And, you know, I've been a volunteer with them for quite a while, and they're just amazing and do amazing work. And then as far as, you know, if you please, you know, come find me if you have any questions or if you just want to kind of see what I'm doing. I'm on Twitter and Instagram as ShuntedMDPhD, or and my name Jamie Wright is on all of my pages as well.
That's a great handle, by the way. Thank you so much. I'll make sure to put links in the show notes to the society and to your accounts as well. All right. Thank you again so much. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you.
I just want to say thank you one more time to Dr. Jamie Wright for coming on and sharing her unique experiences with us. And I'll leave a link to her socials as well as the organizations she recommended in the show notes below. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're getting your podcasts. This helps with the algorithm and getting the show noticed by other people. Also, please make sure to subscribe for future episodes. And you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Kentris or by email at theneurotransmitterspodcast@gmail.com with any questions or show suggestions. And those contacts are also in the show notes below. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you all next time.